he acted illegally, and 29% who said it was unethical but not illegal. Another 38% believed that President Biden did not have any involvement in Hunter Biden's businesses. The opinion poll also found that more than half of voters believed that President Biden acted inappropriately over the investigation into alleged gun and tax crimes committed by his son, whose plea deal with prosecutors fell apart back in July. The opinion poll was conducted before special counsel David Weiss revealed he will seek to indict Hunter Biden before the end of this month in a court filing updating the judge on his investigation into the president's son's failure to pay taxes. President Biden has denied any involvement in his son's business dealings as House Republicans barrel towards a possible impeachment inquiry into the president over issues relating to his family's business dealings. Views about whether President Biden was involved in his son's business are divided among partisan lines. Just 28% of Democrats said he had some involvement in his son's dealings, while 90% of Republicans said he had some involvement, including 76% who said this was illegal. Moreover, the U.S. deficit is projected to roughly double this year, largely due to higher interest rates and lower tax revenues. The Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, an organization that pushes for lowering the deficit, is projecting the federal deficit will double this year to total about $2 trillion for the fiscal year that ends on 30th of September.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent, a weekly show that aims to address the most significant issues in the South Asian region. And in this program, we will discuss America's horrendous legacy in Afghanistan. So stay with us.
In this special episode of The Subcontinent, we will discuss a trail of US misdeeds in Afghanistan. And we shall also take a look at the motive behind launching the so-called war on terror.
The withdrawal of the United States from Afghanistan two decades after its unwanted arrival in the country left behind a nation grappling with uncertainty and turmoil. As we mark 2 years since its shameful exit from Afghan soil, it is imperative to remember the long list of human rights violations during its military presence in the country. While the West claimed that the so-called war on terror brought stability in the country, the reality is otherwise. Civilian casualties, indiscriminate airstrikes, unlawful detentions, and other crimes against humanity form a part of the harrowing reality.
The Operation Enduring Freedom, led by the United States, was launched in 2001 under the pretext of dismantling the Taliban regime. However, the outcome has been marred by a grim legacy. Since 2001, an estimated 75,000 Afghan military and police personnel and more than 71,000 civilians have lost their lives. Reports reveal that NATO-led airstrikes resulted in the death of nearly 1,600 children just between 2016 and 2020. Unlawful detentions became another contentious issue, with tens of thousands held without charges or access to legal representation. According to reports, 70 to 90% of detainees were rounded up without proper evidence. Secret trials, based on questionable allegations, raised concern with no substantial action ever taken. According to human rights experts, the actions of the US government in Afghanistan were a failure, and the military occupation was not only the political hegemony of the United States, but also the hegemony of the West.
The US invasion of Afghanistan, falsely justified under the banner of counterterrorism, reveals a more complex narrative. While the pretext of America's longest war was to eradicate the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, deeper motives that fueled the Afghan war are often overlooked. Buried lies a tale of strategic maneuvering, political interests, pursuit of the mineral wealth of Afghanistan, and the astonishing surge in opium production that unfolded in the aftermath of the US invasion.
Afghanistan's tumultuous history has been marked by decades of conflict, with the opium trade contributing to the violence in the region. Before the US invasion, the Taliban had banned opium production as it went against the laws of Islam. When the US-led invasion ousted the Taliban regime in the early 2000s, paradoxically, opium production surged, transforming Afghanistan into the world's largest producer, accounting for a startling 90% of global output. United Nations data shows a 35-fold increase in opium production since the US intervention, rising from 185 tons in 2001 to a staggering 6,400 tons in the recent years. While the official narrative claimed to fight terrorism, the US forces openly guarded poppy fields in the Afghan countryside and maintained connections with Afghan drug kingpins. According to some political observers, economic interests attracted America to Afghanistan and not the false rhetoric of cracking down on terrorist groups. Strategic relations experts say that the US invaded Afghanistan to loot its vast mineral wealth, including the huge lithium deposits, and to resurrect the poppy fields.
Now let's talk about the women of Afghanistan. By omitting the history of the crimes committed by the NATO military alliance in Afghanistan, the United States has been trying to show itself as a rescuer of Afghan women. However, figures show the real picture. As per statistical data, after 20 years of US presence in Afghanistan, various forms of violence against the Afghan women have increased. Experts say there has been an astronomical rise in cases of self-immolation, trafficking, prostitution, and kidnapping in the past 2 decades.
During the 2-decade occupation of Afghanistan, United States used Afghan women as a symbol to legitimate their bombing campaign in the country and also justify their war on terror. Claiming that the so-called war on terror was also a fight to restore the rights and dignity of Afghan women, the Bush administration declared that the U.S. was able to liberate the Afghan women and guarantee them a rightful place in the society. Rejecting West's claim of women empowerment, Afghan women rights activists have been saying that the world has maintained a total silence over the atrocities committed against women during the U.S. presence in Afghanistan.
Well, Afghan women sadly have been the most affected segment of the Afghan society over the last 20 or 40 years. And the problem is that they have not been seen as sort of a very important segment of society, which nobody can win a war without the help or support of women in Afghanistan. And I think if you analytically look at the data as well, I'm not sure, but I think Afghan women widows would be one of the ratio of widow in Afghanistan would be one of the highest in the world, if not the topmost. So Afghan women have, suffered not just because of the war, but of the economic situation on the ground as well. They have suffered poverty, they have suffered a lot of problems in the last 20 years. When the US was waging a war in Afghanistan, the only aim it had was to achieve a military success in that area. And if it affected women or men or children, they didn't care about at that time. They did say on the surface that they are supporting them through NGOs and welfare funds. But I think that was very little amount that actually got to these women.
Experts say that the early expressions of support for Afghan women in the midst of US military action served to paint a feminist glow on some of the most brutal bombings by America and its allies. Despite Western declaration of empowering the Afghan women, the female literacy rate in the country has not changed in the last 20 years. And the horrors the Afghan women suffered during the violent two-decade U.S. occupation of the country still remain enshrouded in mystery.
We hardly get to hear about Afghan refugees in Western media and the severity of the Afghan refugee crisis. The humanitarian catastrophe brought by the two decades of U.S. occupation made millions of Afghans homeless. The destruction inflicted on civilians by the so-called war on terror has been incalculable. The figures given by the UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency, shows that at the end of 2020, there were around 2.8 million Afghan refugees worldwide, the vast majority of them in Iran and Pakistan. However, the actual number of displacements are probably twice the number.
Statistics show that at least 37 million people have fled their homes during the wars the U.S. military has launched since 2001. However, experts believe the total displaced by the U.S. post-9/11 wars could be closer to 48 to 59 million, as the international statistics generally count only the registered refugees. According to a 2020 research paper written by a joint research team from the U.S. universities of Boston and Brown, in 2015, there were almost as many unregistered Afghan refugees in Pakistan, around 1.3 million, as there were registered refugees, which happens to be 1.5 million. Analysts say that this huge influx of refugees to the neighboring countries has led to socio-cultural, economic, and political effects in the host states, also putting pressure on their resources.
Well, it has been, of course, mishandled on a mammoth scale, for sure. Otherwise, we would not have been where we are today in Afghanistan. From day one, when the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan, the U.S. policy and its allies' policy vis-a-vis Afghanistan has been one of the failures after another one. We have seen that in the last two decades, they managed to bring in a system, a democratic system in Afghanistan on artificial basis that could not survive once they decided to leave. It fell apart the next day when the Americans left Afghanistan. The policy, if we are to assess Afghanistan's situation, we shouldn't be assessing it on the basis of the last 20 years. It should be, it's been more than 40 years that the US CIA and its allies like Pakistan have been trying to maneuver situation in Afghanistan, and they have not been successful in achieving what they wanted to achieve, a democratic Afghanistan.
As per experts, during the 20 years of its presence in Afghanistan, the United States played an essential role in breaking the Afghan society, leaving the people in desperate condition. The displacement caused by the U.S. war in Afghanistan has torn apart families, neighborhoods, communities, alongside other forms of wartime violence.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent here on IRIB English Radio.
Now, to have more insights on this, we are joined by political analyst and journalist Mr. Tahir Khan from Islamabad. First of all, welcome to the program, sir.
Thank you.
You're more than welcome. Now, sir, the U.S. military withdrew from Afghanistan after 20 years of occupation. What has been the implications of this hasty withdrawal on the stability of the country, and also why the so quick withdrawal of the U.S. military forces?
Thank you for inviting me. I would not say a hasty withdrawal, because the US and its NATO allies, they had already decided to leave Afghanistan because they were not successful. And they were the Taliban fighting against the foreign troops. They forced them to come to the negotiation table because the US and the NATO allies were expecting that they would weaken the Taliban. And after the Taliban are weakened, they would go for the negotiation. But that was that approach was not, I think, based on realities. So this was the already the American had in mind to leave Afghanistan. And you would know the Taliban and Qatar and the U.S. A former ambassador to Pakistan and Afghanistan, Richard Olson, for the first time in 2015, they started interaction. But the formal negotiations started in 2018. And so the American had a plan to leave Afghanistan because they did not achieve what they wanted to, because they want to finish the Taliban. They want to punish the Taliban. This was their claim. But Taliban were more stronger, and the American could not achieve their objectives. That's why they withdrew. So I would not say it was a hasty decision, but because they were not successful to defeat the Taliban.
Okay, so talking about Taliban, with the withdrawal of U.S. troops, Afghanistan faced a rapid shift in power. What factors allowed the Taliban to regain control so swiftly?
Yes, I would say one factor was the division among the leaders in Afghanistan that time. Dr. Ashraf Ghani and Dr. Abdullah, they both took oath as president. So it never happened in anywhere. I don't think it happened anywhere in the world. So there was division within the political leadership. And I would say the Afghan National Army was tired, I would say. And they were under psychological stress when the Americans and the Taliban signed the agreement in 2020 on February 29. So that withdrawal agreement was a psychological pressure on the Afghan forces. The second factor was the people did not want more war, because Taliban were fighting in villages, in rural areas, in mountains, and sometime on the road just to explode a bomb. But the people, there was no fighting in the cities, so the cities were safe. And that's why the people in when the Taliban started controlling the provinces, they started from the northern provinces. And Taliban had never been any influence in the north. But because of the people frustration over the war, they forced their officials in different provinces to hand over the provinces to the Taliban. So Taliban started from the north. They took control of several provinces in the north. This encouraged the Taliban in the east, in the west, in the south to move forward, because the army did not want to fight to fight more. The people were not willing that the war should be shifted to the cities from the villages. This was the main factors: political division, the morale of the Afghan forces, and the people pressure on the leadership that they don't want more war. So this paved the way for the Taliban to take control of Afghanistan.
Mr. Tahir Khan, there was another thing I wanted to ask. Was the U.S., when they left, the reason I used their swift withdrawal was because they left a lot of their equipment behind, which is like worth millions of dollars. What is the reason behind that?
I was in Kabul in July, in the last week of July. And I went to the Defense Ministry in Kabul, and I met some official there. I was told by one Taliban leader, defense official, Major General Abdul Latif Hakimi, who was previously the Taliban spokesman when there was a war in Afghanistan. He was telling me that the Americans destroyed many, many things, even the airfields and some infrastructure they have built. And even they tried to damage the tanks and everything, but they could not shift everything. They destroyed many things. So that's why the Taliban government now trying to repair some of the tanks, the helicopters, and other military vehicles. But the American could not take more weapons with them, so because they want to leave Afghanistan.
That's right, sir. Mr. Tahir Khan, the so-called war on terror in Afghanistan led to serious human rights violations by the NATO troops. Now, the perpetrators of the war crimes are still free. Why have the world organizations have been silent over this?
Now, this is a very good question. I would say the double standard of the Western countries, the double standard of the international, some organizations like International Court of Justice, War Criminal Courts. If people were killed in Afghanistan, there were strikes on the wedding ceremonies in Afghanistan, many civilians were killed. So in, they say this is not a human human virus. And the Guantanamo is Guantanamo was for everyone, because you may have heard from the prisoner who spent time in Guantanamo, because I met several the Guantanamo former prisoners. They faced a lot of problems there. So this is the double standard. I would say very briefly that the West, the Americans, the other Western European countries, they have a double standard. For them, human rights is issue is when it favors them. And from in other countries like Afghanistan, like Iraq, like Syria, when people are killed by the Americans or other countries, so for the Americans and the NATO and the European, this is not... So I would say this is double standard. And we still face this approach by the U.S. and the Western allies.
That's right, sir. Before we let you go, sir, one last question. Despite claims...
Please.
I want to talk about the opium trade. Despite claims to curtail opium trade, the production of opium remained high during the U.S. presence in Afghanistan. So my question would be, how did the United States benefit from the drug trade?
This is very simple. If I don't stop the poppy production, poppy opium cultivation, and then they knew, because the Taliban, the American forces were everywhere. I myself visited Helmand, which was the main provinces for these opium production. And believe me, I have seen on the main roads huge fields of this opium production, the cultivation of the opium poppy. The problem is they were, you are right, they were not, they could stop this cultivation of this opium and this drug, but they did not. So, because there was war. There was a war, and they were the control of those areas, but they did not stop them. So it means if you don't stop poppy cultivation or narcotic smuggling, it means you have benefit of all this. And this war, this American war in Afghanistan, the NATO war in Afghanistan, every time you can, if you go to the media in the past, the Americans' factories of the weapons, some Western interests, they were involved in that war, because it was the war was run in Afghanistan by the American Western interests. So the opium production, I think they would be definitely benefiting them if they did not stop those poppy cultivation. And the problem is Americans have left. Americans have gone. They were, I would say, they were defeated. But they left the weapons problem for the neighboring countries, for Afghans, the opium issue. So now Iran, Pakistan, Central Asian, they are facing multiple problems because of the war in Afghanistan. And the Americans are now safe in Washington and New York, and we are facing the problem.
So if you could just shortly tell me, how has the government now contained the opium problem?
I think they had, I would say, I would not say 100% control, because you know that the Taliban also they knew that if there is no alternative to the opium, so although their leader, the Amir, has already banned this, and in many areas, in Helmand and other areas which was traditionally the poppy cultivation areas, I have also heard from many people that now this is not very easy for the very traditional these poppy, the people who are involved in the cultivation, in the business. So to some extent, I would say it has been controlled. But I would not say that fully the Taliban have controlled this, because Taliban also know that if you totally ban these things, so maybe the people would suffer and the people who are depending on this. And the second thing is the international community, especially the West, who brought the war to Afghanistan, they are not very interested to help the common people. Because when I was in Helmand last year, the local people were telling me that they were forced to stop the cultivation, but they were complaining that they were not given the alternative. So the Americans, the European and the NATO, they should help those people who are forced to stop this cultivation of the poppy.
They have 20 years to do this. Mr. Tahir Khan, thank you for being with us, sir.
Welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. There you have it, political analyst and journalist Mr. Tahir Khan from Islamabad. Glad to have him on the program. Now let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Izzat Ghafouria, journalist, tweeted, "My pen is unable to write their pain. The crimes of America and England in Afghanistan are unforgivable. This young man was 10 years old when his father, mother, and three sisters and three little brothers were bombed and dismembered." Nar Edley, founder and director of Mint Press News, wrote, "In 2016, when the US military dropped bombs on Doctors Without Borders Trauma Hospital in Kunduz, Afghanistan, killing over 40 people and injuring hundreds more, the Pentagon investigated itself and concluded it didn't commit war crimes." Asif Durrani, Pakistan's special representative on Afghanistan, tweeted, "Being the champion of human rights, the US should voluntarily submit its record of human rights violations in Afghanistan and Iraq, where approximately 900,000 people got killed. At the same time, Guantanamo Bay concentration camp is still operative." Maliha Hashmi, a journalist, UN consultant and trainer, tweeted, "The US, UK and Australia and other countries must be held accountable for human rights violations by their military in Afghanistan." Chen Zhu, China's UN envoy, tells Human Rights Council. Alex Rubinstein, an independent journalist, posted, "Eagerly awaiting a Pandora Papers-style info dump explaining where the money from Afghanistan's opium trade is sitting. Afghanistan went from having 7,606 hectares used for poppy cultivation in 2001 to 328,000 hectares in 2017. According to US military, a 4,212% plus increase since invasion."
And that was our episode on 2 years since the humiliating US withdrawal from Afghanistan. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take care.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. In the limelight.
New figures show that the number of people declared homeless due to eviction in Scotland has nearly doubled, as more Scots face uncertainty in the housing market. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British News of the Observer has covered this story and tells us more. New figures show people living in the most deprived areas of Britain have seen their rents increase by 52% over the past 4 years. While for tenants in the wealthiest regions of the country, rents have risen by only 29%. Dan Wilson-Craw, Deputy Chief Executive of Generation Rent, said, "It is shocking to see that home rents have been rising in areas where people are least able to afford it." The countrywide data analysed by the state agent Hamptons and shared with The Observer reveals that how in 2019 renters in the most deprived regions of the country were paying an average of £499 a calendar month. By 2023, that had shot up to more than £759. In contrast, those renting a property in Britain's most affluent districts were paying an average monthly rent of £1,078 in 2019, and that's gone up to £1,387 this year. Pauline Neat, Chief Executive of Shelter, told The Observer, "The private rental sector is creaking under the weight of demand as rents spiral out of reach of local incomes and tenants are pitted against each other for a limited supply of homes." According to the state agents, Hamptons, landlords in less affluent areas rely more heavily on mortgage finance than their wealthiest peers, helping to drive up costs. Interest rates have gone up from 1.75% in August of 2022 to 5.25% today, with some passing on rising costs to renters. Tenants in deprived districts of the country have seen their monthly rents increase by a typical £97 since 2022. Wilson-Craw said, "Over the past couple of years, more people have wanted to live in cities where areas of high deprivation are concentrated." Craw added, "Financial pressures have pushed many renters into relatively cheaper areas of cities to find an affordable home, and the effect has been to push up rents for those people already living there." The figures reflect how Britain's continued housing crisis is combining with the cost of living crisis, as rent, mortgage rates and rising food prices and energy costs are squeezing incomes. Scottish newspaper The Scotsman Daily has also covered the same story and tells us more. Renters are already more likely to be living in poverty. According to the 2022 annual poverty report from the Joseph Rowntree Foundation, a third of private tenants, or 4.2 million people, are in poverty, driven by a combination of high housing costs and low incomes. Almost a half, or 46% of private renters living in poverty, say they have been pulled into poverty by their housing costs. Of the most deprived regions in the United Kingdom, the district with the highest percentage of rise in rental costs was Lindhouse in Glasgow, where monthly rents increased from £597 in 2019 to £985 this year, a rise of 65%. Just under a third, or 30%, of children in Glasgow City live in poverty. For tenants in affluent Ascot in Berkshire, rents are higher than in Lindhouse in Glasgow, but the percentage increase is far lower. Monthly rents rose from £3,224 in 2019 to £4,163 in this year, 2023, an increase of 29%. Child poverty rates in the wider Windsor and Maidenhead region are 19%, and more than two-thirds of Ascot residents own their own homes. The Joseph Rowntree Foundation data found that 20% of low-income households taking on new debt to pay for rent and energy. Esther Planners, a 62-year-old, has called Hackney an East London home since the late 1990s, when she moved to the United Kingdom from Spain. An artist, she has lived and worked in the borough of Hackney ever since, admitting that in some ways she was part of the gentrification. Esther Planners is now faced with having to leave her home due to increasingly high housing costs. Her landlord recently informed her that her monthly rent will go up from £1,175 to £1,620, an increase that she cannot afford. She told the Scotsman, "It's a huge amount of money," adding, "I live in a vulnerable and precarious context as an artist. My income is from selling my work, teaching, lecturing and grants. I considered becoming officially homeless and getting help from the local council, but the waiting list is years long." This is not the first time rising rents have forced planners from her home. Her previous landlord evicted all the residents from the block of studio flats where she used to live. Now the street is full of VIP apartments.
Welcome back to Aperture. Before we follow Javad, an Iranian nature explorer and documentary filmmaker, to the desert regions in South Khorasan province, an area of vast desert, sand dunes, and aridness as far as the eye can see. But amid what looks like arid wasteland, at first are wonderful and amazing surprises, including canyons, freshwater springs, and traces of past civilizations. But perhaps what is even more amazing, the next part of the program, is that this dry, arid land yields the world's most coveted spice and Iran's prized red gold, saffron.
I leave behind the ruins of Dihuk and its beautiful architecture for my main destination, which is the terraced saffron farms of Esfandiar, a patchwork of little farms that demands the attention of any visitor. The name Esfandiar was derived from the word espand, or wild rue plants that grow in abundance in and around this village. In the spring season, perennial plants make the mountains surrounding Esfandiar all the more beautiful. In my opinion, this village is a masterpiece, home to many and varied beauties in and around it. The people of Esfandiar are kind, faithful, and hardworking. Farming is the main occupation of the people living in this part of the country. And their main produce is Iran's famed red gold, that is, saffron. The fragrant, vivid crimson threads are known by almost everybody around the world and has forever been the world's most expensive spice. In the words of researchers, the history of saffron goes back thousands of years. Iran was the first place where these beautiful flowers were planted. And after Iran's neighboring countries such as India, Syria, and Lebanon found out about it, it was also planted in Greece for the first time. The word zafaran is the Arabicized version of the word zarparan, meaning a flower with petals of gold. Saffron threads are plucked from the flower saffron crocus and used mainly as a seasoning and coloring agent in food. Historically, saffron has been among the most expensive spices in the world. Harvesting saffron is so labor-intensive. Every 150,000 crocus flowers that weigh approximately 75 kilos yields a meager 1 kilo of this sought-after spice. The crocus bulb grows multiple flowers for several years, but after that, the number of its buds decreases by the year. Still, there have been instances where 30-year-old bulbs bloomed too. Around the world, saffron is used as food seasoning, medicine, dyeing agent, and fragrance. At the moment, Iran is the world's biggest producer of saffron, accounting for 90% of the world's production. Saffron has been used as a coloring agent for 50,000 years. Signs of that application have been discovered in drawings found in caves in Iraq and across the Achaemenid Persian Empire. Sumerians used it as medicine and for making certain potions. Iran's South Khorasan province is the main producer of saffron in the country. The reason I've chosen Isfandiyar is the many other stunning sights to see apart from the beautiful saffron farms, the beautiful pomegranate, fig, and almond gardens. The lofty mountains behind the village reaching to the skies, the vast terraced saffron farms, and the very hospitable people who are a valuable asset for Iran. Add to that the beautiful ancient village of Isfandiyar that has lain uninhabited for around 30 years for fear of earthquakes. Beauties have turned Isfandiyar into a peerless little paradise in the heart of the desert. I'm overjoyed at the knowledge that the village has maintained its original shape, everything from the architecture to the farmlands. Thanks to my good friend Abbas Amiri, a village council member and a schoolteacher, and the other responsible inhabitants of the village, no one is allowed to make even the smallest changes to the architecture of the buildings in the village and of those nearby. I hope that the authorities of the Cultural Heritage Organization and the responsible villagers living here will join forces in preserving and renovating the unique architecture of the buildings in Isfandiyar, give local and foreign tourists a chance to relish in such a beautiful bucolic environment, and leave a precious legacy for posterity. Additionally, a move like that will help the country's tourism industry to thrive and create jobs for the locals, provided that not a single modern structure is built in this area, and the landscape is clear of paved roads, power posts, and other eyesores. I spend the whole day walking around in the mountains surrounding Isfandiyar and taking beautiful photos of the village from different angles. I'm supposed to accompany my good friend Amir, a village council member and high school teacher, and his kindly wife to a saffron farm. I want to see up close how they and other villagers pick the saffron threads. It's freezing. It's 6:30 in the morning and most of the villagers have already sat down in a squatting position on their farms picking saffron-bearing flowers. I really didn't want to get out of my comfortable bed and come out here in this biting cold and dry weather. But the best time to pick those flowers and to see the farmers at work is the very early cold hours of morning. Apparently, it has to be cold and it should still be dark when they start picking the flowers. I better get going. Very cold, very. It is mid-fall and the best time to harvest the saffron. The cold early morning fall weather in the desert is ice cold. Time is of the essence for these saffron farmers, so they have to make the best use of the time they have. From the day when the first saffron crocuses burst into flower, the farmers have around 15 days to pick all of them. Therefore, they cannot wake up anytime they want and go to work anytime they please. There is a certain time during all those 15 days at which the farmers can pick the flowers, and that is only the early morning hours. All the villagers, men and women, young and old, lend a helping hand on the farm during this period. It takes a certain degree of skill to pick the flowers, and the older folks of Esfandiar are master pickers, hands down. If you leave those flowers under the sun for too long after they have bloomed, your saffron is going to lose most of its original aroma and taste. It diminishes the quality of your saffron, as if the aroma of the saffron gets released into the air and disappears forever. That's what I'm told. You have to pick the buds with the longest stems, and you have to do it fast. There is no alternative to the human hand when it comes to picking these flowers. No machines, no automatons, no nothing. The men and women of the village spend hours squatting or doubling down while picking the flowers. The cold weather and the time crunch on the one hand, and the pressure on the farmers' knees and backs on the other, make the job ever more difficult. The tips of the fingers tingle from the bitter cold, and nagging pain starts to be felt in the knees and back. The work is agonizing and toilsome. Desert dwellers are tough human beings, and do not easily give up in the face of the difficulties presented to them by life. These people's entire being is made up of hope and love of life. They are eternally grateful to God, even when doing the most difficult of work. The young people, too, hum local songs as they work. After spending only a couple of hours with Amir and his family on their farm, I'm completely worn out. The pain in my back and knees is excruciating, but I feel great, because during those 3 hours, I got to see firsthand what these hard-working people go through. I can feel their pain. But there's something that upsets me and all of Iran's saffron farmers. Unfortunately, the farmers do the lion's share of the work in producing saffron. A case in point is the back-breaking harvesting process, but it's the middleman who stands to make most of the profit. That's an issue that calls for proper management and careful planning. The farmers need help to cash in on the result of their hard work, to make a profit that makes it all worth their while. Another big problem is a lack of proper, internationally interesting packaging industry in Iran for exporting saffron. A country like Spain is making the best of this opportunity. It buys Iran's high-quality saffron at a very low price, puts it in beautiful, modern packaging, and re-exports it to other countries in its own name and at a much higher price. The margin of profit is staggering, and that's what the farmers here have been complaining about. I am depressed after watching the farmers work so hard and hearing out their problems. But Amir has a present for me to cheer me up. To refresh themselves and shake off the cold after the working hours, the farmers get together somewhere next to their farms and brew themselves some fresh tea laced with fresh saffron in a pot on fire made from dry sticks. Locals here believe that saffron tea cheers you up. It makes you laugh. It helps freshen you up. But for someone like me, the question that comes to mind is, how can you not be happy when you hang around with such hardworking, kind, pure souls? How can you sit down with these folks, sip saffron tea with them, and not be filled with joy? The fact is that even without this state, saffron tea I mean, you get filled with peace and happiness when you hang around with people who spend all day from morning till evening doing back-breaking work. Cheers. After imbibing that delicious saffron-flavored tea one sip at a time, I decide to sit down with one of the elders of Isfandiyar, and that is none other than Mr. Danai. He tells me about the desert people's frugal existence, about their simple lifestyle, about the tough days of famine many years ago, and the perseverance and resilience of his fellow villagers in the face of the vicissitudes of life. The farmers don't have any time to waste. Therefore, after picking the flowers, they usually sit down together and start the next phase of saffron production, which is plucking the stigmas from the flowers. That's why I believe those who live in deserts or near them are very patient people. See for yourself. Take a look around. It took a lot of patience for them to turn this steep surface into a terraced farmland. Then, with a lot of hardship, they planted the saffron bulbs in it, spent months attending to them and waiting for them to yield. As far as I know, saffron crocuses bloom once a year. It takes a lot of elbow grease to cultivate them. They don't need much water, but still growing them is no walk in the park. Everything about saffron requires a lot of hard work and patience. That's why I've come to believe that desert dwellers are very stoic. Whatever they do calls for a lot of patience, and if they aren't patient, things won't happen. They won't prosper. The pain Mr. Amiri has in his knees and back is a pain that everybody here shares. All these people work really hard on these farms. And as I say, those living in desert climates are super patient human beings. Being in their company gives you the kind of peace that defies description. The last stage in the production of saffron involves spreading the stigmas on a proper surface and leaving them to dry. And that's a job that has to be done with a lot of care and skill. Otherwise, the quality of the end product will be impacted. In the end, the middlemen come to the villages, buy the dried saffron from the farmers, and sell it at staggering prices after proper packaging. I have high hopes for this beautiful village to be reconstructed and renovated. I hope that on my next trip to Isfandiyar, I see many tourists here. There aren't many places on Earth that share the same natural, architectural, agricultural, and anthropological variety as Isfandiyar's. But unfortunately, those beautiful houses you see behind me, although they used to be people's homes one day, now lay in ruins. No one is paying adequate attention to all the historical, cultural, and architectural beauties of our beloved country. I'm sure each one of those houses in this beautiful mountainous region, with all these vast terraced saffron farms and its beautiful gardens, not to mention its very hospitable residents, I'm sure if they are renovated, they can act as hotels in this region to accommodate tourists coming from other countries and, of course, local tourists traveling to this region. They can become beautiful hotels offering peaceful moments to those staying at them. My trip to South Khorasan has come to an end. I'm leaving with beautiful memories and valuable knowledge of this region of Iran. Before setting out for this part of the country from the capital city, I wouldn't even dream of such spectacular scenery and such kind human beings. I traveled to this area to see the saffron crocuses growing in the desert. I found the beauties of South Khorasan as a treasure trove, each of which is as beautiful as Iran's famed saffron. All this area needs to turn it into a major tourist attraction is proper attention and management on the part of government officials. And all that is possible if the traditional lifestyle of the folks living here does not undergo any radical changes, and provided the untouched scenery in these areas is not despoiled by modern residential and industrial structures. the beautiful face of deserts and the wilderness, the sand dunes and mountains, the animal and plant species living in deserts, an unpolluted blue sky, clean air. Beautiful, vacant yet livable villages. The farms and gardens of the area, and on top of them all, the genuine and hospitable people with a rich culture. Each and every one of them is as precious as the saffron produced in the desert of South Khorasan. All I wish for is for all these assets to be preserved and protected for future generations.
Perhaps next time you enjoy another Persian dish with the exquisite scent of saffron, you will remember the terraced saffron farms of Isfandiar and the kind and hard-working farmers who plant the little purple flowers and harvest strands of red gold. And that's it for this week. Do join me again next time here on Aperture for another documentary. Goodbye for now.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
British Petroleum has reported $2.6 billion in profits after hottest month on record. Climate advocates note that oil and gas profits are soaring like the temperature increases they are responsible for. This is while Britons are struggling with the cost of living crisis. According to new reports, England is facing a homelessness crisis, with the number of people living in temporary accommodation in England at a 25-year high. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Truthout noted, the London-based oil giant BP reported second-quarter profits of $2.6 billion and announced a 10% dividend raise for shareholders on the heels of what was likely the hottest month on record, a grim milestone that scientists say was made possible by the burning of fossil fuels. While BP's profits for the second quarter of 2023 were far lower than the massive $8.5 billion it logged during the same period last year, a drop caused by falling global oil prices, the company has still raked in $7.6 billion in profits so far this year. The company has set out those profits to investors in the form of share buybacks and dividends. BP said in its earnings announcement that it will repurchase another $1.5 billion worth of its shares over the next 3 months.